I'm Owen.
And I'm Chris.
And this is the Dead Wargamer Society.
So, once again, we managed to get Dave Taylor to join us. We didn't scare him away the first time. So, welcome back, Dave.
Thanks very much for having me, guys.
So, you know, obviously there's been a few things going on since the last time we had you on. I know that even though there's not a Nova this year, I believe, right? That there's still a Nova Open Charity Foundation raffle.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, definitely. I mean, last year they also ran the raffles and had, despite not having the event, they had the best year ever for ticket sales. So I think they're hoping that this year will also be pretty significant with ticket sales. So they had a fantastic first week. So far, over $60,000 in ticket sales, I think.
Whoa, nice.
And we've got until the end of August, or August, I think it's August 28th, something like that.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think they've got 45, 46 different raffles running. I've done a crazy Chaos Knight conversion for 40K.
Mm-hmm.
It took the idea of Slaanesh and XS to the XS. So I took the very cool new mini from the Hidden Knights of Slaanesh from Age of Sigmar and stuck it on top of a 40K Knight Tyrant and
nice.
Did some fancy feet and just made an incredibly tall knight that's going to tower over any piece of scenery.
Yeah, no, it's I saw the pictures of it. It is, I was going to say it's probably one of my favorite conversions ever, but it's also 100% my favorite knight that I've ever seen built. It is so over the top, Slaanesh.
Yeah, I wanted that over the top, that really over the top feel, which is cool. And it's like, I don't often post on the Evia Metal Facebook group, but I thought, hey, well, I may as well post this one. And you got something like 1,400 likes.
Whoa.
Like, that's a pretty crazy reaction to something. I've never got that many likes on anything. It was like, I'm glad that this has struck a chord with people because I've been looking at it for the last 6 months.
Yeah.
So awesome. It's pretty cool.
So have you been up to any Kickstarter stuff lately?
I have actually. Yeah. Earlier this year, I launched a Kickstarter to basically create the start of a book series that I'm really interested in seeing grow. It's a series of books called The Art Of, and it's basically the miniatures art. Oh, a whole bunch of people whose stuff I really like. I've got three. The Kickstarter has funded the first three books of the series. There's a book from Miniature Monthly. That's Aaron Lovejoy, Elizabeth Beckley, and Matt DiPietro.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a Patreon called Miniature Monthly, and they do a lot of video tutorials, and they do individual coaching. They do a lot of teaching, basically. They do brilliant artwork and they teach people how to create their own brilliant artwork. So excited about putting that together. Book two is quite relevant to tonight's conversation, I think, is Christoph Kyle. Christoph's done, does incredible kit bashes. I mean, I really enjoy converting, but Christoph is just leaps and bounds ahead of my approach, I guess. He does some spectacular work. And I'm really excited to be working on his book. And then the third book is Anna Palanstrup, who is more in the, I guess, the fantasy side of the 28 kind of movement. Anna does, again, spectacular works, very, very dark, sort of grim, dark fairy tales kind of feel is probably the best way to describe that. A lot of very macabre stuff. So, so they're the first three books. Working on laying those out at the moment. I think Christoph sent me an email on the weekend. He has finished writing his text for the entire book, and he's just doing his final sort of sitting down, reading over it all before he sends me through the last pieces. Probably about three quarters of the way through laying out Anna's book. And this week I've got meetings with Aaron and with Matt to make sure we're on the right track with their book as well. So
nice.
Coming together. Very excited to be sort of messing around with this project. So publishing, me doing the publishing, but bringing the art, the miniatures art of these people to the public in this format, I guess.
That's awesome.
So yeah, definitely definitely super cool.
Sweet deal. So we normally talk about what we're doing hobby-wise on the show. Dave, what have you been up to, man?
I've been doing a bunch of stuff, working on a Soul Black Gravelords army for Warhammer Age of Sigmar. I'm going to play in the team tournament at Adepticon next year.
Nice.
When we finally get back to Adepticon. Woo! So, yeah, three other good friends of mine, we're all working on a vampire army, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that. And I just received a big box today full of toy soldiers to start working on another Gaunt's Ghosts army, Tanith army, that I'm going to do for myself.
Nice.
Pretty cool.
Nice to hear that you're doing something for yourself for a change.
It's all good. I just did some commission painting and painted up a Kragnos.
Nice.
That's a very cool model. Quite nice to work on. Pretty much more straightforward than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I've seen that in person. It was surprisingly restrained, given how intricate some of the larger kits have been from them lately. I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely definitely nice. It should be fun for my client to use. I had to read through the rules, and it's like, oh my god, this guy's. I hope I never face him on the tabletop.
Nice. Oh, mercy. Chris, what have you been up to, man?
So I took a break again from that Cursed City commission. It's roughly like 60% done or so. That's good. It, just to take some breaks to break up, you know, the 70 or so models in it. And I painted up some 3D printed Hero Forge created models that are stand-ins for Relic Blade that are actually of the bridal party, one including Owen. And then we also took the 3D sculpts for Zara and I, and we blew it up to like 4 inches tall or so. And I painted those up where it looks like statues almost to be cake toppers at the wedding, terrain in the future after they're cleaned off. So that's been a lot of what I've been working on. It's been a fun project.
Awesome. How did the details hold up being blown up that big?
So pretty well. It's funny. I tried to go with a local guy at first to low up the models and also just to print the models at standard. But the way they put, I got the STLs with the bases on them, and that can be just a tricky thing. So he even had some trouble with the models and the details at 28 mils, so when they started going bigger, there'd just be like an entire section of missing leg, or right. You know, half the face would be melted. So I actually talked to Bobby Limojo, who has been heavily investing in 3D printing. He's picking up licenses for a few different model lines to print for people commercially. So he's got, you know, better equipment. He's been really trying to kind of practice with better support placement and things like that. And he was able to print out the larger ones with no problems on the first go, which is pretty impressive.
That's cool.
Yeah, especially, you know, we'll have to put up some pictures in the notes after this, but like the one for Zara is standing on the base with like 1 foot barely connected to it and has a super like tall, skinny bow.
Okay.
So it definitely is not, you know, something that is a simple, easy to support things. And the files from Hero Forge don't come with supports like on the files.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm very impressed with the work that Bobby put into this.
Cool.
Nice, man.
Yeah. What about you, Owen?
I've actually been working on some Relic Blade for somebody's bachelor party, so I don't want to talk too much about that, but somebody asked me to paint up a bunch of battle pigs, so I've been slowly working on some stuff there. I've shown some of that to Chris to make sure he wasn't like, oh god, this is terrible, but I'm holding some back as a surprise. So that's been fun. I've also been playing around with a lot of Turbo Dork paints. I'm planning on using them in my Conquest army for some of my Hundred Kingdoms stuff. I'd like to do the Gilded Legion using some of their color shifting paints. So I've just been trying to get a handle on the best way to use those, the best way to pen wash them, doing some experiments there. Been having some fun, but also getting some other stuff done. As part of that, I actually painted up the majority of my 300-point Urban War Force. So kind of a blast from the past in terms of miniatures, but they were really a perfect test subject for those. Lots of nice flat armor plates, which is really, to my mind, an ideal place to put those color shifts and put that down, put a pin wash on them, filled in the other details. painted up really quick, but it's a sharp looking army from 6 feet away, which for something that I'm probably not going to play a whole lot of in the future is exactly what I need it to be. But other than that, it's been all conquest all day for me. For a minute, I have another 1,000 points of Spire on the table that I'm trying to finish up by the end of the month. Work has thrown me some curveballs, so I think that's probably going to be early August so that gets done. But just trying to finish up about 5,000 points for the year. We're on track for that, but just a matter of keeping the train moving in the right direction.
Nice. So speaking of, you know, painting stuff up to actually play games with, now it's going to be the first time we've done this on a podcast, but there's actually events coming up, like conventions, which is really exciting. And as far as dead games at conventions, there is an Eden tournament that will be coming up at ArmorCon, which is in Marlborough, Massachusetts on October 16th. I know both Owen and I are planning on attending that.
Well, I'm actually running it, so I better attend it.
Attending, running, you know, it's the same thing, right?
my only quibble there is I wouldn't even call it a tournament. I call it an event. There's a core group of us that have been wanting to play for a while. This is a great opportunity. We're all going to be in the same place at the same time, so let's play. I don't even know that I'm going to do Swiss pairing. I'm probably just going to do round robin through the 6 or 8, whoever many show up. But just trying to get back out there and get things going. I think this will be a great icebreaker for the season, as it were.
And shortly after following that, there is Dark Age After Dark at Dragonfall in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. That's October 23rd. Unfortunately, Owen and I won't be there. That's entirely on me because my wedding will be October 31st. And yeah, I'm dragging Owen to that. So
you monster.
I'm terrible. But yeah, for anybody who is in the area, anybody who wants to make it out to a convention, that's definitely going to be a terrific event. There are really good things about it. And each time we do a podcast, we'll be sure to add some events like this. So if you have a dead game event kind of coming up in the future, whether it's like a tournament or a big casual play day or something at a convention, just shoot us a message about it so we can pop that onto this list.
Yeah, the only thing I will add is the events for Dark Age and Eden at CaptainCon 2022 have been accepted. I don't have definite times or schedules for them yet. The schedule for the overall convention hasn't been released, but there will be some events there, and we're discussing submitting some more. So keep an eye out for that. But also, if you are going to be going to CaptainCon and you really want to play something, reach out to us. We'll be happy to help organize something for you to, you know, play some dead games. We can support you with mats, terrain, getting people in the room. So if you you have any ideas there, please don't be bashful and please reach out.
I like this we, like it's not just you. Like, oh yeah, Chris is gonna do all this stuff. No. I'll play games. Like if someone's like, hey, let's play some Eden, I will gladly just play some Eden in the hallway, you know, but I'm probably not bringing tons of terrain with me to Rhode Island. That most likely won't happen.
Anyhow, let's get down to what we actually are all here to talk about tonight, which is a game from Games Workshop called Inquisitor. You may or may not have heard of it. It was put out in 2001. It was somewhere between a role-playing game and a more narrative version of something like Necromunda. It's been interesting to see how this game has advanced over the years. I would say as a role-playing game, it's been probably pretty much firmly supplanted by some of the other GW role-playing game products set in the Warhammer 40K universe. But as an inspiration for some interesting community games, it's been something of its own beast. So first we're going to talk about what Inquisitor was, and then we're going to talk about kind of where Inquisitor went. So I'll start with where Inquisitor started. I'll give the usual wiki-style summary. So Inquisitor was a narrative war game designed by Gav Thorpe and published by Games Workshop in 2001. It's notable for requiring a GM or Game Master, using 54mm miniatures, and having a looser structure, and by that I mean there weren't any points in the game, than other Games Workshop properties. It also was notable for featuring a darker tone than some of the other games released around the same time. There weren't the usual happy, goofy orcs. It was something a little bit more grim and probably more familiar with people that are used to the in the grim darkness of the future crowd. Official support was provided via White Dwarf Magazine, Exterminatus, Fanatic Magazines, three supplements released between 2002 and 2004, but support for the game definitely stop somewhere around 2007, around the time that Specialist Games, as all the non-mainline GW's games were called, was stopped. So we have Dave here, who worked with Games Workshop. So I guess I'll start out by asking Dave, have you ever played Inquisitor?
I have to say I have not. So okay. Yeah, the fun part here is that that I never actually played it, but I was with Games Workshop in Australia when it launched, and we did a lot of sort of the primary support that we did for it was showing people how to convert the 54 millimeter minis.
Okay.
Because they came out with there was a pretty significant range. In the end, there was like probably close to 40 or 50 models. But there are also a number of conversion packs that that came out. So we showed people how to convert them using those conversion packs, and also with green stuff and Plasticard and that kind of thing. I remember going through and building. I worked on taking the Space Marine character, Brother Artemis, and turning him into four different essentially Chaos Marines. So there was a Corn Berserker, a Plague Marine, a Thousand Suns guy, and a Noise Marine.
Nice.
Sort of converted out of the Brother Artemis model. A lot of the staff that we had at the time were excited about doing those sort of conversions. We had one of the store managers converted a giant, one of the older metal giants, into an Ogryn. Mm-hmm. So he gave him a really big gun and did some green stuff work so that he looked like a 54 millimeter Ogryn. So that was pretty awesome.
Nice. So you're pretty keyed into the GW community overall. What's the community's feeling on Inquisitor? What was the feeling, I guess, on release, and what's the feeling like today?
I think in general, I think specifically, there are people who are very excited about exploring the dark corners of Warhammer 40,000. Mm-hmm. War 40,000 lore and that kind of thing. There's that tagline, in the grim darkness of the far future, there's only war. And the background for 40K and all of the way that the game works is everything's like big and grand. It's armies fighting armies across sectors of space with all sorts of wild and crazy things. But particularly like recently, there are like books being released for battle zones, and here's like Warzone Charadon or Warzone Nihilus or whatever, where there is huge sweeping. So it's basically the world is presented in a huge sweeping way. Inquisitor sort of spun back on that and sort of dived into those dark corners that I mentioned, where everything was brought back to like the daily life or the daily grind of being an Imperial citizen and what might happen there, and if you saw the wrong thing, who might show up and sort of carry you away in the darkness. So Inquisitors keeping an eye on things to make sure stuff doesn't get out of hand, but of course their methods are very incredibly brutal, and you can look at there and say, well, that's out of hand already. So I think there is a group of people who are really excited about that, but that was very definitely not the vast majority of Games Workshop's customers. As far as from a commercial point of view, it was not particularly successful at all. One of the other sort of bigger things was that it was, as a 54 millimeter game, sort of a game with 54 millimeter miniatures, you wanted to play all these really exciting adventures and stories and scenarios, but to do so in the dramatic way that you wanted to, you needed to create 54 millimeter terrain.
Yep.
So Games Workshop released like two pieces of terrain at that scale for Inquisitor, but it was just a very difficult thing to do for most people. And I say most people, like for 99% of people who might stumble onto it and sort of pick it up in a casual way, like, very quickly you sort of realize, no, this is a little bit too tough. I might just go and play some 40K or I'll play some Necromunda or, oh, wait, maybe. Then there was a large group of people who went, I could play this with 28 millimeter miniatures and I could convert them to look like the 54 millimeter guys and then just get in and play using my Necromunda terrain. So I think initially the Games Workshop, if they wanted to explore the dark corners, they would have been better off had they gone directly with a 28 millimeter game, but they didn't. And so I think it was more that they wanted to put out these 54 millimeter miniatures and see where things could go. Mm-hmm. But fairly quickly they found that no, it's not. It wasn't commercially going to be the success that they wanted it to be.
Well, I know that in Australia, y'all usually pay a pretty hefty premium for things from, say, England or America, just due to transit there. I can't imagine 54 millimeter miniatures were terribly affordable, all facts considering, down there.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I really couldn't tell you how much we sold them for. Yeah, no idea. And also I will also say that in the early 2000s, like, we knew we were paying a little bit more, but we didn't, there wasn't a lot of internet activity, so it wasn't sort of particularly clear how much more. From that point of view,
it's definitely not like now where it's like, oh man, if I'm curious about what, blank costs, because something's in euros or something's in, sterling pounds or what have you, I can just like Google, how much is blank in US dollars, and it'll pop up and tell you exactly what this is.
Yep.
But before that, there was that little bit of like ignorance on it where it's like, it's kind of sort of this. I'm sure it's not too bad.
It was that kind of thing. Yeah. So people who really, particularly in Australia, people who were getting it, they were buying them, the minis, because they wanted to paint them. They wanted to do big, like Brother Artemis was a perennial favorite. People always wanted to paint up a big space marine. But in the end, it just wasn't commercially successful. I think there was one story, just quickly, I will tell, is I was getting really excited. I was building up a squad of Tanith, making a lot of camo cloaks and converting the Commissar Gaunt and that kind of thing. I had like probably 7 or 8 models on the go, and I had them all in a figure case. And I used to catch the train to work, and had to switch at a particular station. And this one morning, I was taking my stuff to work, and I sat down on the platform. I put my case next to me, talking to some friends who showed up, and then the train arrived. We all got on the train, and about 30 seconds later, I realized I'd left the case on the platform.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was like, hopped off to the next station, catch the next train back, and of course, by the time I got back there, it was gone.
Oh.
And I never found it. And it sort of took the wind out of my sails for quite a while.
Oh.
Yeah, understandably.
Yeah, it's quite depressing. But yeah. Anyway, moving on from that.
One thing I noticed reading the rules of Inquisitor was they had a lot of things that have been tried recently by Games Workshop again. It's like having a Games Master, which is something I've seen in AOS narrative play as a suggestion, and also the lack of points, which is something that Games Workshop tried with the initial launch of AOS. Are those things that are more popular with English gamers than they are American gamers? Because I can tell in the States those are not widely popular things. Is there a group of people that really like those things? Because it was surprising to see them 20 years ago, then tried very recently here.
Right. I think the concepts are, or the maybe not the concepts, but the drive behind gaming is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly with historical gaming, I will say it probably has a larger following in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of the folks like Jervis Johnson and Rick Priestley were more driven by narrative gaming, setting up something to tell a story. And so things aren't necessarily going to be balanced. And I put balanced in air quotes. Whereas the type of gaming that Games Workshop has always built towards is that idea of, I bring a 2,000 point army, you bring a 2,000 point army, we throw down, and the difference will be which one of us is a better general. So mm-hmm. that's kind of what GW has long promoted as the thing, even if they haven't sort of called it out as the thing that they're promoting. So they've basically created a customer base that are all about, okay, well, how do I balance this? How do I know that this is balanced? And you see that they've done a lot of work over the years with different scenarios that are asymmetrical. There's a lot of different approaches that they've tried to take to twist that a little bit and make it and promote the idea of sometimes gaming can just be about the fun,
mm-hmm.
about the story, and who wins or loses doesn't really matter. It's the story that you tell along the way, kind of thing. I know, shock horror, it doesn't.
I think the other things that I've seen a little bit more is, you know, while, you know, like role-playing and tabletop wargaming for a while were similar in the fact that they're both just nerdy pastimes, there wasn't a ton of crossover. And yep. It seems like more and more like there is a lot more role-playing aspects among all of these games. And that, you know, I'm sure, you know, a little bit has to do with that resurgence of D&D. I mean, there's Magic the Gathering now just came out with their D&D set. It became a huge popular upswing, especially with the pandemic and Stranger Things and everything else. So it seems like, you know, like role-playing isn't a niche thing anymore. It's definitely much more popular. And I could see wargamers kind of coming around to it a little bit more than it used to be before, where it was like, no, you know, like I play war games because, you know, I want to have the points, I want to have the rules, I want this to be balanced. Now there's a little bit more of like, oh, you know, maybe I do just want to sit down and play through a game, you know, like I want to have an experience more than a win.
Yeah I think one of the other aspects as well that's probably driving this, at least from Games Workshop's viewpoint, is that the thing that they own are the stories.
Mm-hmm.
You can't copyright game rules. So focusing on a situation where the gaming experience is all about the who rolls what dice kind of thing isn't unique to them, whereas exploring the dark corners of the 40K universe or creating a huge battle in front of the Gates of Terror kind of thing, that's the experience that is theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to make sure that that's always present somewhere, even if it's not always what they promote sort of as the focal point. They're trying to walk a fine line between inviting people to tell their own stories and making sure people are telling the right stories. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's kind of an odd balance that they have to walk. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but yeah.
No, I think it gets to why people keep coming back to these ideas, even when in this instance they haven't worked out great. I would look at it as, if you told me that English gamers tended to be clubs where people knew each other, had long-term relationships with each other, as opposed to a lot of American stores where you might go to your LGS, but people will flit in and out a bit more. Having something like points makes it a bit easier to have a discussion on, let's play a game, I'd like it to be fair and fun for both of us. And without any sort of structure for that, that can get cumbersome to the conversation. So we want to play an Inquisitor game. Well, my Inquisitor has a retinue of 2 Space Marines. I don't really know how many dudes to add to my Inquisitorial retinue to make this kind of an apples to apples thing. And maybe the point is it doesn't need to be, but I think there's a concern if, you know, someone shows up with 10 Space Marines, someone else shows up with 10 guards, it's going to be maybe not as fun as it could be.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there. There's a level, once you, there's a level of trust is really what we're talking about, isn't it? It's about the social contract of gaming, and having something like points in a sort of fairly arbitrarily balanced sort of situation provides a lot of trust, provides a framework of trust, I guess. Whereas something like playing a game of Inquisitor is, you're not going to walk in and just pick up with somebody you've just met and play a game like that.
Yeah, and I think it's, even if it's not points, you look at role-playing games. Okay, if I want to play D&D at my store, they might have a, you know, come and play an adventure. Here's either a pre-made character, which, okay, that's different than wargaming. You don't need to paint anything. Or it might be, I'm looking for a group. We're going to start at level 3. Build a character that meets that. Talk to me about your concept and make sure it's cool. I think if you just even had like something like, what is it, battle level or threat level in 40K, where it's not points per se, but it's kind of something to give you an idea of about like how to make roughly equivalent forces.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's definitely, I'm really not I'm losing the words. I will come back to it.
Sounds good. Speaking of coming back to things, do you ever see GW coming back to Inquisitor?
I don't. Okay. I don't. I think primarily because the success of something like that, even if they were to come back in a 28mm sort of fashion, the success of it relies on that storytelling ability, that ability to go off script. And I think Games Workshop definitely want to keep people on script, which is why In my feeling, it's why that they've done things like they've dabbled with the concept or with the wild concept art of John Blanche and that kind of thing, like with the Kill Team Rogue Trader box set, mm-hmm. and the sort of the Rogue Trader and their crew up against the Gellipox infected. And it's like, that's a fantastic thing. Like, they could have both been released as a box set for an Inquisitor 28 kind of scale game, but they wanted to keep it in a very contextual sort of situation.
Yep.
So release it as part of Kill Team. People can take the models and do whatever they like with them, but Games Workshop's going to tell you that these work best on this board moving between these rooms kind of thing. So yep. I think that's the way we're going to see it. Do I think Games Workshop's going to explore the dark corners a lot more? I really hope so, and I think that they will. It's going to be within the context of something larger. Something that they've got that script written for.
I feel like they've done a better job of exploring the dark corners, but I feel like the places that they do that and have done it successfully have been things like Black Library novels, and I could also see them moving in with the new animation studio more into that area.
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah, I think you're exactly right there.
We talked a little bit, but there's been a lot of community to work to make Inquisitor more approachable. So what a lot of people have been trying to do is to bring it from that 54 millimeter scale to a 28 millimeter scale and adding a little bit more structure, like points for models, to the rules. What's your take on that? You know, do you think that's something that's helpful to bring it to the community or to more people?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely is. I'm going to say, I think I mentioned this to you guys before we started recording, but three C's. I'm going to throw out the three C's here, which is where I think that things are going with the Inquisitor, or the Ink 28 idea, or Inquisimunda, or really any of the movements. I'm going to call them movements rather than sort of gaming communities. Community, collaboration, and creativity. So creativity is a very important part of this. But the community and the collaboration are also an incredibly important part. So I know that there are people who have been doing this kind of thing for a long time. They've been creating these games that will work in the dark corners. They've been creating warbands. They've been creating characters, stories, everything that could incredibly plausibly fit into the 40K universe, but might not necessarily have been explored by Games Workshop. So. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it started in the sort of around 2009, 2010. I guess people picking up after Inquisitor had been dropped by Games Workshop, but also sort of at the height of the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. So a lot of fantastic bloggers who are creating their own miniatures, creating their own stories, blogging about it, and then other bloggers finding them and saying, "This is great. I love what you're doing. I'd like to work with you." And that's those collaborations are kind of what has built the community, and they've created sort of touchstones along the way. So different events that have been run. And when we're talking about rules, I think a lot of those folks who have been in the community a long time don't really worry about rules at all. Mm-hmm. Just basically create a cool story, and then we'll work the rules to fit around that cool story rather than what are the rules. How do I create a warband? What points do I use, or what weapons can I choose from? No. That's not how it's done, kind of thing. So you see a lot of those sort of conversations on different forums or in different groups. It's like, oh, what rules do you guys use for this? And the answer is always like, I don't know. Or, well, it's kind of like Necromunda, but it's like a mashup of this or that. Well, is there a link to it? No. So from a accessibility point, I think there are a lot of fantastic access points to it now. A lot of fantastic artists who post a lot on Instagram, like Christoph Kyle posts Cornell on Instagram, and so many others have found, like, are using Instagram to sort of put out their work. A lot of people are still using blogs. So there's a lot of touchstones to ask questions about the movement. The reason I'm calling it a movement is that it's not just about the gaming. It's about the storytelling and the collaboration. So I think for the approachability, the accessibility point, that's sort of there. And there, no doubt there are other people who are just like, I want to create some cool models and I want to play lots of games with them. And those people are primarily using Necromunda rules with modifications, changes to scenarios that they create. But the focal point, I think, of a lot of the Inc28 stuff is about that collaboration. It's about finding somebody who's created a story that you really like and asking to become involved with it. There have been a whole bunch of them. I opened up a few tabs here. Spiky Rat Pack blog, which is probably a fairly sort of seminal Inc28 blog. The Inquisitorium forum, the Iron Sleet blog. There's a whole bunch of blogs people can go and check out to see the development of different things. The folks who run Iron Sleet are very much in that collaboration. There's an idea, somebody has an idea for a story, a scenario, and then everybody gets involved in creating something for that. So one of their first big events that they did, or one of the early events, was the Pilgrim, which they did. They ended up playing that at Warhammer World along with John Blanche.
Nice.
So that was there's a whole bunch of Inquisitors and their retinues and other characters and that sort of thing that were all on a pilgrimage to this location. And there were a lot of stories, like a lot of backstories, a lot of interaction between the characters that were created by those players. It wasn't that the game master said, okay, well, you're doing this now and you're going to do this, and these people are involved, are going to come together and sort of artificially drawing people together. It was allowed to sort of evolve organically, where if one artist really loved the work of another artist and wanted to work with them towards this a particular goal, they just talked about it and they worked out how they were going to do that, how they would create something that complemented, or maybe they wanted to create turn that person into their arch nemesis. So there's a lot of different ways that people went about that. And that's that sort of approach, that collaboration approach, is really at the heart of that, of the Inc28 movement as such. I mean, an example of that is the Goleta, the Frozen Expanse setting that guy in Utah, Cody Taylor, kind of created. And he had a whole bunch of people jump on to collaborate with him, to the point where there were three different events being organized around the world as part of this Goleta setting, which was on basically a frozen planet. People live in arcologies under the permafrost, and they can only really go outside in that, like, the equatorial band of the planet. And it was something that I saw and I read, and I was like, this sounds fantastic. And people were creating all of these walkers, or these transport vehicles with crews that were all bundled up, furs and warm clothing and that kind of thing. And I looked at that and was like, oh, this is fantastic. I want to create something for this, but I know that I can't get to go to any of the events. So I got in touch with Cody and said, hey, can I create something for you? And he goes, oh yeah, it'd be great if you can do something we can use as an objective. So I did like a mech pilot that was outside his mech, because something had happened to it. It had fallen in a crevasse and he couldn't get it out. So he had to escape and try and get back to one of the trade routes before he froze. So I created this objective marker and sent it off to Cody and said, oh, here's what I'm thinking for him. And then let Cody sort of take the rest of the story the rest of the way.
Nice.
If you think one of the best ways to be involved in it is not to think about what the rules are for it. It's, what's the story? How can I create something that enriches this story, enhances this story, works within it, but expands it a little bit more? That's kind of a fairly long way to say, yes, it is more accessible. No, it's in 28 mil scale. People do add structure to it with the rules and points values and that kind of thing, but it's not beholden to any one thing.
It's interesting because you also mentioned, you know, a little bit of that difference between the Inquisitor 28 and the Inquisimunda, you know, specifically in that Inquisimunda seems to have more of those rules, like the, you know, you're kind of mainly using a lot of the Necromunda rules, points, and things of that nature. The Inc 28 seems to have more of that movement feel to it, where there's really not a great idea of like, well, what rules do you use for this or that? Some people on the Reddit have suggested things such as rules for like, this is not a test, or Stargrave, and so on. Added like the two out of Inc. 28 Inquisimundas, they're either that you're more excited about.
I would sort of think that, yeah, like Inquisimunda, or the idea of playing Inquisitor games using modified Necromunda rules, is really like a subset.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas the Inc. 28 is kind of the overarching movement, or the idea, or the concept, which is the bigger thing. So, really, I like the idea of playing games, or create. I like the idea of creating or dabbling within the Inc. 28 sandbox, mm-hmm. which is really the 40K lore sort of sandbox. So I'm probably more excited about that as an overarching concept rather than specifically using Necromunda rules. While I do play Necromunda, and I have really enjoyed Necromunda over the years.
You know, as somebody who does do more of the narrative gaming, you know, and you've had more experience with that, do you have any tips or ways for people who are interested in Inc. 28 or Inquisimunda for kind of growing that kind of group or encouraging that commitment?
Yeah, I do have some thoughts. The main one would be, rather than if you don't have a group that is able to commit to a campaign mm-hmm. kind of aspect, definitely work towards a single, like, one-off event.
Mm.
Create the seed of the story, put that seed of the story out there, find people who are interested in it and who want to commit to evolving that story and growing it with you, and who can make it to the event that you're creating, be that an event at a store or an event at a convention, or the folks I mentioned from Iron Sleet. They have the Iron Sleet Invitational, where they have, I think they're working on their fourth invitational event, where people who are working with them, collaborating with them, will be invited to come along to a hotel somewhere, probably in Scandinavia, because most of the folks that are Scandinavian, and participate in the event, play in the game, which might be one big game, but chances are there's going to be one big game. There'll be a whole bunch of smaller spin-off games that'll be done. But that would be the kind of thing. Get people to commit to a weekend and build it from there.
Right on. It's interesting to hear about ways to set up different types of communities. And we've talked to people like Greg from Dust, who, I'd say the Dust community is a little bit different temperamentally than a lot of the other communities Chris and I have been in. So it's just been interesting to hear ways to kind of cultivate different approaches to wargaming than what people are probably used to from, say, a War Machine or a Warhammer 40K. So I think that sounds like a great idea. You know, Necromunda, I think Chris and I have talked about this before, is a game that I feel like every gamer my age, if you bring it up in a conversation, oh, I love Necromunda, it's awesome. It's like, cool, want to play a game? You know, that's like a commitment. So I do appreciate the guidance there. I guess kind of tying back to what we talked about earlier, though, you mentioned that GW seems to be on a bit of a tear in terms of trying to get people to tell stories the right way. This seems kind of a bit different than that. Do you think there's any risk of GW ever going after somewhere like Spiky Rat Pack or any other like larger blogs? I don't really know what they can go after them for, but making their lives tricky in terms of if they like put out a PDF with some of the GW IP.
Do I see that they're? Do I think they're going to do that? I don't think that they are.
Okay.
It depends on how they're presenting it, I guess. I know that recently Games Workshop updated their approach to sort of protecting their IP, whatever they're in. I can't remember exactly what it's called. It's not intellectual property rules, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
They recently updated those, and it's caused a little bit of a kerfuffle in the community. But those updates are based on changes to UK law.
Okay.
Games Workshop suddenly upping the ante. It's just unfortunate for Games Workshop, for the optics on it, that it arrived sort of 2 weeks after their announcement about Warhammer Plus. So there's that. But I think because we're talking community-based stuff, we're talking about people organizing their own events, while the 40K universe is, or while the Imperium is deeply fascist, I don't think Games Workshop is going to sort of step to the to the level of sending goons around to knock on people's doors while they're playing games in Quizzen Under for a setting that Games Workshop hasn't written yet. So I think from that aspect, it's that people are going to be absolutely fine.
Awesome.
As somebody who is going to be publishing books about miniatures and stories that people have created using Games Workshop's background and miniatures, we looked at it, and Christoph and I have started talking over the last couple of weeks about how we can use Games Workshop art that has inspired his conversions in the book. So there's a few conversations I've got to have with some people to find out whether that's going to be possible under fair use law. At no point, though, am I worried about Games Workshop coming knocking on my door and saying, hey, you've got to stop this. Yeah, so I don't think that there needs to be too much worry about it. Games Workshop's concern is always about, are people misrepresenting themselves, or are people misrepresenting Games Workshop? That's the main thing that they're concerned about. Yeah. So, but yeah, one group to definitely check out who are doing some fantastic work in presenting these stories and presenting the conversions that people are creating or the artwork that they're making is the 28 Mag. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you guys have checked that out. 28-mag.com. It's a fantastic group of artists who have really been involved in the Ink 28 movement, and also all of the other sub things that have created that have sort of spawned from there. So things like AOS 28, so Age of Sigmar 28. We know Age of Sigmar is incredibly high fantasy. It's super bright and vibrant kind of look, particularly when you've got your like orcs running around with bright yellow armor. You know that you're in a high fantasy setting. But AOS 28 is again taking the elements of Age of Sigmar and taking it down a very dark and grim and dirty. So there's AOS 28. Basically, we're almost to the point where if people want to explore that sort of grim, dark look, but in a different setting, it's really have a word and throw 28 at the end of it. And I say that because there are things like, I don't know if you've heard of Turnip 28.
Yep.
So Turnip 28 is... it's a setting that exists outside of Games Workshop completely, and it's all about it. But it's a grim, dark angle on World War I/Napoleonic warfare with a root vegetable twist. And it's like these three things. It's really, really amazing to see these three things put together, but they fit. So it's kind of odd. But yeah, so there's a guy who's written a rule set, I think possibly called Turnip 28. Mashups, for the last like decade, mashups have been sort of a crazy thing where it's almost like, okay, well, we've worked through everything, we've reiterated everything to the nth degree. Now we just need to mash things together to come up with something new. But when you put them together, it's like, oh, that's wild. And it's definitely attractive to those people who aren't particularly worried about points. Mm-hmm. And want to create a story and tell a story, right, through their gaming. So and even I when I was looking back through the Iron Sleet blog and looking at the Pilgrim event, it was like, okay, here's the game, here's the blog post about the game. But it started off with the first part of the blog post was the night before the game, we all sat down in Bugman's bar and we had a look at the 160 plus miniatures that were going to be involved in the gaming, so that we could all ooh and ah over them and ask questions about how they were converted and tell me more about the story for this guy and that kind of thing, because they knew that they were going to do that. They had to do it on the Friday night so that they could actually get some gaming in on the Saturday. If they hadn't done it on the Friday night, they would have spent most of Saturday doing the ooing and ahhing over the minis. So yeah, I think it's a cool thing. I love the idea of it. I was actually slated to run an Ink 28 game at or two games at Adepticon 2020. So I had to, started building a story based on a story out of one of the Warhammer horror anthologies on Silence, which was a cemetery world. And I just love the idea of a cemetery world. There was like taking two things that I'm familiar with, planets and cemeteries, mm-hmm. and matching them together in a particularly like grand 40K scale where the whole planet is now a cemetery. So it was creating a story around that and then inviting people to come along and then saying, okay, well, what warband do you want to bring? Why would you be coming to the funeral of this particular sort of sector commander? Hmm. And people bringing their own stories and then me working with them and introducing them to other people in the, who are going to be playing in the game so that they could start working together and evolving their story. But at the same time, because it was here, a whole bunch of people who don't know each other or they haven't played in this fashion before, it was like, okay, well, we're going to use the Necromunda rules. And really, when it comes down to it, they're like, okay, well, so do I pick a gang and just use their equipment? And I was like, no, pretty much come up with whatever you want. Think of the story first and the models that you want to create, mm-hmm. and then we'll work the rest out from there.
Nice.
I'm sure that you can end up with some sort of, somebody might go in and game that system and create something sort of that would break the game. But the great thing about having a game master is, like, if something like that pops up, you can go, well, see, this statue has just fallen on that guy. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the grim darkness of the far future, these things happen.
Sometimes it's poor architecture.
Poor architecture, but, yeah.
For people that haven't seen it, too, that's featured in Inquisitor or Ink Magazine number 3, and we can include a link to that in the show notes. Dave's assembly of the World of Silence was really inspiring, and I think you used, was it 500 skulls, 1,000 skulls? How many skulls again?
Way too many. I can't remember. but a lot. There are a lot of skulls on that. One of the things that I built into the background of that story is that the reason that it's all on sort of 12-inch squares is to create a fun table that has sort of, that there's like flagstones, but undulates like a natural landscape, is that it's set on, the water table is rising underneath it all. And sometimes that cracks these big concrete or rockcrete platforms. And when that happens and the skulls of the dead sort of start to rise up through these cracks, like, okay, well, we've got to put another big rockcrete slab down here. So they will come in, move mausoleums away, drop the slab down, put the mausoleums back. So the landscape is always changing. And of course, you could have some of your characters trapped on a particular square when the administratum accidentally drops one of these things in the square and everything's destroyed. It's like, oh, we weren't supposed to do that till next week? I'm sorry. Because that's perfect sort of imperial bureaucracy. I don't know. It's cool. I mean, I could talk about this forever. So,
moving along to just fun general questions for you, Dave.
Yep.
What would be your favorite GW plastic kit over the past 10 years?
That's a really good question. I saw it on the show notes, and I was like, I don't know.
Like, man, you had time to prepare. This wasn't even like totally random.
I know. It was like for the last 4 or 5 days, I've been agonizing over it. I don't know, but from I think from an Ink 28 perspective, it would probably either be the Skitarii sprue, mm-hmm. Skitarii Rangers and Vanguard sprue. It could be that. There are lots of great items on there, and the whole idea of like all of these troopers have their legs replaced because they've rotted off due to like rad poisoning is fantastic. Either that one or the Neophyte Hybrid sprue from the Gene Stealer cult. That one is fantastic as well. Such a cool look. It's something that's much more, it's a grimdark take on a sci-fi look, whereas a lot of the other 40K sprues are grimdark takes on historical looks. I liked that it had a bit more of a sci-fi feel to it, I guess.
That's funny. With the two kits that you're mentioning, that essentially you'd really like to encourage people to get that old out-of-production Kill Team version 1 starter box.
Right. Oh, yeah, because it had both, didn't it?
Yeah, it had both of those in it, and a whole bunch of super awesome terrain that would have been great for, you know, Inquisimunda if it wasn't out of production and, you know, scalpers selling them for like $600 a box, right?
Yeah. those Sector Mechanicus kits are gorgeous.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely awesome. I think GW is actually bringing some of those back to their to the website.
Oh, nice.
I saw it. I think I saw it on the Week in Warhammer little blurb that they do each week. But yeah, those I've done a whole table of terrain for my Deptus Mechanicus army and my Gene Steeler Cult army to fight over using that Sector Mechanicus terrain. It's very cool. Yeah, so I'd go with those two kits. They're awesome. And blending them with some Necromunda stuff, and you can get some really great Ink 28 models going on.
Cool. So what would be your favorite hobby product that you think isn't terribly well known?
That's a good question as well. And I don't have a good answer for that one. I think all the stuff I use is fairly basic. I probably would have said the Testers Model Masters polystyrene cement would be a must, but Testers have stopped making that now. I know they still make their regular polystyrene cement, but that has a plastic tube applicator rather than the metal tube. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to clean. So I've switched to the Citadel plastic glue, which I discovered has that metal applicator tip. So I like that.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, so if anybody happens to be wandering through a hobby store and they see the Testers Model Masters glue, it's a little black container with a red label. Pick it up. It's great.
Interesting. Yeah, I use the blue toothpaste tube of the Testers Non-Toxic. Because it smells like oranges. The nozzle is definitely a little large for what it is, but using like a little bit of like scotch tape or something to narrow it down is actually a nice little tip. But it's super cheap. It's only like $1 to $2 a tube, and it seriously just smells like citrus while you assemble your models, which is really pleasant.
I'm an old school modeler though, so I kind of feel that if it doesn't feel like part of my brain is being eaten away by the scent.
Right. Moving along to our last question for you. Who do you think has the better seafood, Maryland or Australia?
Speaking of an early grave, I don't know if I misanswered this.
Man, like, seafood is super healthy though.
It is fantastic. Well, I mean, it's tough as well because Maryland itself has a fairly limited range of seafood, whereas Australia has an incredible range of seafood. I think Maryland also has a focus on the blue swimmer crab, the blue crabs of the Chesapeake Bay. But I will also say that the bulk of Maryland's seafood that is like famous Maryland famous comes in from the Gulf. So, and anybody having a crab feast now is not having Maryland crabs. They're having Gulf crabs. So I'm going to go for Australia. I say we have a wider range, and I don't think Australia, well, I tell a lie. Australia does import some of its seafood. If you have any prawns in Australia, maybe not any, but a lot of the big king prawns, they're probably brought in from Malaysia or Indonesia.
Mm.
So, I don't know. I'm going to go for Australia.
I was gonna say, this was also just super interesting to me because Owen comes from Boston, you know, who added this question. I was like, man, you know, like, I actually like Boston seafood more than Maryland.
Well, I mean, Dave is currently living in Maryland. He used to live in Australia. I mean, he visited Boston. I don't know if he, like, went on a seafood tour, so...
I didn't. Yeah, I was recently in Boston and in Maine. And while I was in Maine for, it would have been like 1, 2, 3, 4. So out of 4 meals in a row, 3 of them were lobster. I had a lobster roll for dinner. The next morning I had a lobster roll for breakfast. And then the following dinner I had a whole lobster.
Nice.
So that was good. I mean, I really love lobster, but since having those 3 meals of lobster, I was like, I'm really looking forward to like the next time I have crab. Steamed crab, pick it out of the shell, dip it in some vinegar, and it's like I think I'm coming down on the Maryland side there. So I apologize for that, Owen.
All right. So on that note, Dave, do you have any shout outs that you'd like to give to anyone?
Uh One that I will do, we mentioned at the beginning of the show, the Art of Kickstarter. So the Kickstarter ran earlier this year. You can head to Kickstarter and type in The Art of and look for books about miniatures. But we have the Backer Kit pre-order store is open. So again, if you head to backerkit.com and type in The Art of, you can head in and check out those products. Have a look at the Kickstarter to see some of the updates and some of the photos that we've been posting. Check out the work of Miniature Monthly. So if you can find them on Facebook. Miniature Monthly, you can see the fantastic artists who work for that. Call them also K03RNL on Instagram. And also Anna Polanchuk is Gardens of Hecate, both gardensofhecate.com or Gardens of Hecate on Instagram. You can check out their fantastic work, particularly if you're into the Inquisitor Ink 28 kind of angle. Christoph and Anna's work will be right up your alley.
Awesome.
They're my shout outs. You can probably find all of that on DaveTaylorMiniatures.com as well.
We'll include links to all that goodness in the show notes too, if people want to check it out that way. But we do encourage you to check out DaveTaylorMiniatures.com. We should probably also mention the Discord. We'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. If you like what you hear and want to talk about it with other like-minded gamers, head on over there. We got a great community that loves talking about stuff. We'll see if that includes talking about seafood, but they do definitely like talking about dead board games. So even if you don't get your seafood chat in there, we'll help you out on the other front. But I think that's about it. So on that note, I'm Owen.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Dave.
Thanks for joining. Intro music is Axe to Mouth by Pulp 45, which is Owen's old band. Outro music is Control My Fate by Ataraxia, which is Chris's old band. All songs used with permission. If you like what you hear, please like or subscribe. Thanks.
I'm an old school modeler though, so I kind of feel that if it doesn't feel like part of my brain is being eaten away by the scent, right. I don't think it's going to work.